Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program was brought to you by Itoen, the leading green tea company and makers of Oi Ocha, Japan's number one selling green tea. For more information, visit itoen.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And I have a very special guest today from Japan, and his name is Everett Kennedy Brown, who is a photographer, journalist, and author based in Japan, where he has lived for the last 28 years. He's also an advisory panel member of the Japanese Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, which is a government advisory council to explore ways to boost Japanese economic growth through promoting cultural industries. And he is the co-owner of Brown's Field, which is a holistic organic farm retreat located 40 miles east of Tokyo in the Bozo Peninsula. So today we'll discuss what Everett discovered in Japan, in Japanese culture for the last 28 years, and what his life is like on the organic farm retreat, and much more. So hello, Everett. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Hi, Akiko. I'm very happy to be here today.
Thank you. So you're from Washington, D.C. and have lived in Japan since 1988.
Yes.
So why did you decide to go to Japan and live there?
Well, as a photojournalist, when I was in my 20s, I was often going to Japan to do stories. And I had had such great experiences there that I fell in love with the country and decided to marry it.
Okay. And, you know, I heard you've been traveling really a lot of places, including different places of Asia, right?
Yes.
So, but why Japan as a place to live?
Well, you know, whenever I went into the countryside, I was just having these mind-blowing experiences, meeting great people, stepping back into time in many ways. And I just felt so comfortable in Japan, the landscape, the people.
Right. So that's interesting that you said Japanese people tend to emphasize on tradition compared to other countries.
Yes. But at the same time, it's the leading edge in a lot of technology, with cuisine. I mean, it's like if I want to eat the best Italian meal, my choice is in Tokyo.
I heard that from my Italian chef from Italy.
Sure. Yeah. Do you know why?
Nope.
Because the sous chefs in most of the Michelin restaurants in Europe are Japanese. And it's very much a part of the Japanese craftsman mentality to steal the secrets of your master.
Right.
And so they go to Europe, they get themselves into the best restaurants in Europe, and they're very humble, very quiet, very watching, and they steal the secrets of Europe's best chefs.
Right.
And the chefs are happy because they've got these Japanese sous chef that are making the meals just as they want them to be made.
Right, because their attitude is not to ask questions and told the answers. They have to really see the master's movement, and they have to steal. That's the only way to learn.
Exactly. Because what happens with a lot of American chefs or European chefs, especially young, high-end chefs, is they want to make their mark. And often their taste, their sensibility interferes with those of the master chefs in the restaurant.
Right. So I think the attitude of the Japanese young people, like sous chefs in France or Paris or in Italy, I think it is a respect to tradition. Tradition is something already perfected.
Yes.
So you don't want to mess with it.
Yeah. And so, you know, they come back to Japan. They've been able to master the flavors that they learned in Europe. And then they have this idealized vision of, say, you know, French cuisine or Italian cuisine, and then they make it their own.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And, well, then let's go back to your job. So, you know, you worked as a photographer, but at college you didn't study. You majored in foreign civilizations and literatures, but not photography. So how did you learn taking pictures?
Well, actually, when I graduated from high school, I didn't want to go to college. I wanted to come straight to New York and get into some studio and learn the trade. But, you know, I was talking with my father. He was a Presbyterian minister, conservative. And he recommended some interesting colleges to go to. And he said, go, get an education, and then do what you want to do. And so I found a college called Antioch College in Ohio that had this work-study program. You're on campus half the year, and then you're traveling half the year. And this was perfect for me.
Right.
Because, I mean, it gave me the opportunity to see the world and to study the things I wanted to do, to read the books I wanted to read.
So you picked a camera as a kind of medium to see the world.
Yeah. But, you know, I've been a professional photographer since the age of 14. I first picked up a camera when I was 11.
Oh, wow.
And just holding a camera, I became electrified. I saw the world in a different way.
Interesting.
And so, I mean, since I was a child, it's always been my passion.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about your art, you know, photographic art later. But so that means the camera can capture something you don't see with your eyes or something deeper.
Yeah, the camera, you know, it allows us to focus, to really pay attention to detail that we usually don't. And I use the camera to see the world.
Interesting. And in 2003, well, I mean, you went to Japan and then you did a lot of different things. I think you started working for major publishers, right, as a photographer, like photojournalist. So, how did you find the job and how did it happen?
Yeah, well, actually, it's very interesting. In the 1980s, I was living in Bangkok working as a photojournalist, and had a Japanese girlfriend. I was studying Japanese in Bangkok. And I met one of Japan's leading photojournalists at the time. And he had an agency. He and his buddies started up an agency. And they invited me to come to Tokyo and join their agency. And this was in the 80s. The industry was booming. And I had been to Japan before on assignments and loved the country, loved the food, loved the people. So I moved in 1988.
Wow. Yeah. So that's how you got a job. And then you worked for major publishers, right? So, and also you wrote a lot of books so far while you were with them.
Yeah, well, you know, because of my connections with the publishers and with editors, they like my photos, but you know, we go out drinking at night, and they like my ideas, and so they started asking me to write, and I did a few magazine series, and then right before the 2002 World Cup. In Japan. Actually, it was 1998 this was happening, but the world, you know, all the preparations for the World Cup were coming up. And I had been photographing and interviewing professional soccer players who were working in Japan that came from all over the world. And one of the players was he had been the captain of the Brazilian soccer team, Dunga. And I went to his house, and we spent an afternoon talking. And he took this box out, this big old wooden box. And out of the box, he took out this samurai helmet and put it on his head. And I got a photograph of that. And when the editors saw that, they said, okay, we got to do a book. This is fantastic.
Wow.
Because in Japan, you know, people are looking at foreign professional athletes. It's just coming to Japan for the money. But like a lot of these guys, they were in love with the culture. They were in love with the samurai spirit. This is why Dunga, you know, had this whole samurai outfit. Because it was a part of his spirit.
Right. It's like martial arts. It's more like discipline and much deeper than just physical training.
Yes, right. And a lot of professional athletes were coming to Japan to get more in touch with that. And so that was my first book.
Okay. Is that the Oritachi no Nippon? I don't know.
That's
the English.
Right.
Okay. What's the English name?
Oritachi Nippon is, Ori is kind of a cocky way of saying me or us.
Right.
And so it's our Japan. And so it was photographs and interviews with 11 of the leading foreign professional athletes.
Okay, so our means non-Japanese, our athletes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because, I mean, they, you know, in Japan, people don't really appreciate their samurai culture as much as we do in the West.
Right, because it's kind of half forgotten after generations and then only seen movies. Like very exaggerated way. And people remember like bloody cutting people and that kind of thing.
Yeah, something from the past.
Okay, so these athletes really saw it as living spirits.
They were living it.
Okay, I think I have to read that. I kind of forgot about it usually, right? So, okay, so so that was the main message for your book of Oritachi no Nippon.
Yes.
What else did you write?
Well, so that was published in 1999, and then about that same time, there was this interesting fashion phenomena going on in Tokyo, especially in the Harajuku fashion district, called Ganguro Girls, blackface girls. And, I mean, media from all over the world were just really picking up on this.
Okay. Well, by the way, the Harajuku, if you don't know, listeners, it's main part of, like, one of the cultural, pop culture, you know, like, or it's the ground zero place.
What's the equivalent in New York?
I don't know, maybe East Village?
Yeah, maybe, right.
It's kind of like not sophisticated way, but, you know, like cute things made it into some like, I wouldn't say dirty, but some complicated, you know, like underground cultural thing mixed with...
Well, there's a lot. It's really like a kaleidoscope. I mean, there are lots of different elements of youth culture. But this this blackface girls phenomena was getting a lot of world attention. And so a German publisher contacted me about doing a series of portraits of these girls. And that was fun.
Wow. Yeah, so it's like the moment. It's like a snapshot of what's happening as a cultural phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, that really was the what was going on in the around 2000, 2001, 2002. Mm. And what was interesting was that the Japanese media were like really looking down on these girls as sort of a, you know, kind of an immature youth culture.
Mm.
But in my book, what I was saying was that, in fact, no, these girls were actually preserving a lot of aspects of Japanese traditional culture.
Huh.
They had basically created their own tribe.
Mm.
And, you know, I interviewed over 90 of these girls, and it was amazing some of the things that they said. They said, it was like, you know, in modern Japan, there aren't festivals like there used to be. So the reason we paint our faces black is because we want to have festivals in our life.
Interesting.
And, it's actually a very interesting phenomena. It's sort of this very old current of Japanese cultural energy that just popped up in the center of Tokyo's youth district.
Right. So what missing is found in youth culture.
Yeah.
Right. So we should pay attention to what's, you know, maybe it looks crazy, but there are some hidden messages underneath.
That's it. That's right. And so these ideas got a lot of attention in Japan because, you know, the leading social critics, anthropologists and all hadn't picked up on it.
Mm.
And so it was fresh,
right.
And it made sense. And so from that, I started doing more and more writing.
Mm.
And that was actually the probably the major factor that I was approached by one of Japan's leading intellectuals called Matsuoka Seigo, and he wanted to do a book of dialogues with me, and that became our book, Japanese Power. Or in Japanese, Nihon Ryoku.
Mm.
And that book was very successful.
Right. Mm. So maybe you are really the medium to reflect what's happening. Objectively, you were able to observe what's happening in Japan with insight. So that's why.
Well, you know, my background is photography. You know, I try to look at things in a different light, and I've just had a lot of experience in Japan. So over the time, I've been able to develop a fresh perspective.
Right. Well, speaking of, in 2003, you started working for European Press Photo Agency,
yes,
which is OEPA, which is an international news photo agency,
yes,
with global network over 400 professional photographers, and your title was the Chief Photographer of Japan. So what did you do at the EPA?
Well, they approached me because they wanted to open up an office in Tokyo. And it had to be an established photojournalist, someone who could speak English and Japanese.
Mm.
And it was chief photographer work. It was also being the bureau chief. And I honestly, I wasn't sure that I was into spending too much time in an office and managing a company, it sounded like a new opportunity and an opportunity to see parts of Japan that I hadn't before.
Mm.
So I set up the office, established all of our credentials with like the Prime Minister's office, the Imperial Palace and whatnot, and got a team of photographers. And had an amazing ride for 9 years doing that work.
And your work appeared in most major global media, including National Geographic, Time, Newsweek, Le Monde, New York Times, all major mediums. So,
yeah, sure.
Right. Okay, so what is the most memorable experience while you were at the agency?
Oh, my God.
Well, one or two.
I mean, a number of things come to mind. Well, spending all day with George Clooney.
Wow. What was he doing there?
he was doing a it was an advertising campaign, actually, with a watch company.
Mm.
And I've been hired to go around with him and photograph him doing different things. Actually, we did it several times. Well, also like meeting the emperor.
Okay.
But I think what you know, when I left the agency, the thing that I realized that I'm never going to be able to do again.
Hmm.
You know, I might be able to meet George Clooney again or the emperor, but something I probably will never be able to do again was ride on the prime minister's airplane.
Okay.
And
wow.
Yeah, and that was cool. You know, I enjoyed that because whenever we'd go somewhere on the way back,
mm-hmm.
We'd be invited up to the front of the plane,
right?
And there was sort of like a suite area there, mm-hmm. where the prime minister would meet people, and we'd sit down with him and chat.
Right. So it's is it very special? Like, you know, they change the attitude. It's a very secure and secretive place, so it's a very special environment. So.
Yeah, very special. Mm. And yeah, I mean, in Japanese, it was really kind of the feeling of doki-doki suru.
It was like my heart pumping.
Yeah, but I mean, really feeling, you know, going into the inner sanctum. Because, I mean, you know, I'd spent a lot of time in the prime minister's office, like the White House.
Right.
But it's different on the plane.
It's totally exclusive.
Yeah,
But I'm curious about the emperor. So he's like very hidden figure.
Yes.
Like secret. Mm. I mean, compared to British, you know, system, I think Japanese imperial system is very... preserved or protected by media too, right?
Yeah, so. I think overprotected actually, because he's very hot. He and the Empress are very heartfelt people, and I wish that more and more people knew about the things that they do and for the country. Well, I shouldn't say for the country, but for the people,
right?
For the Japanese people,
in more not directly into the politics, but it's more sort of a image or cultural
and
emotional
figure. And spiritual,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Somebody has to say that. Maybe you can say that more because Japanese people are not allowed to say it.
Yeah. Well, I've thought about it. I've thought about it because, you know, for example, in 2011 during the tsunami the crisis involved with that, around that, the emperor and empress were eating very, very simply because there were people up in the Tohoku region that were suffering without food.
Right.
And how could they eat splendidly if their people were suffering?
Right.
And they spent a lot of time praying.
Mm.
But by the way, the empress is Christian.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yes.
So Michiko, right, she went to a Catholic college, and, right.
Yeah, so it's, what they do is wonderful.
Wow, I wish I could know more about them, right, because I think it's not going to be, you know, the system is not going to be abolished, but you have to understand to preserve it too.
Yeah,
right.
And actually, I think it's really important. I mean, it's a very delicate issue in Japan, but, you know, there's a growing mood of nationalism in the country.
Mm.
And this is not good.
Right.
I really think that rather than nationalism, patriotism is more something that should be promoted and cultivated so that people have a heartfelt love of the country and not an idealistic
So nationalistic
agenda
means more politics and the military actions involved, but the patriotism is more genuinely spiritual and love for the country.
Yeah. And that's really where Japan's strength is.
Right. Okay. And so you left the agency in 2012 after 9 years of work there. So what's your main activity now since then?
Well, my experience with the tsunami, the and everything that followed after that
5 years ago
really shifted my view on Japan, on the media, and also about my role and what I should be doing. And I had been doing my personal work using a 19th century photographic process called wet plate collodion photography. I love it because it goes beyond photography. It's very much like a potter using glazes. And this might be a bit difficult to explain on the radio, but when I take a photograph with this process, the glass negative is wet. And so I can manipulate the negative while it's wet to create lots of different effects, like a potter uses glazes. And I felt that this process was most suitable to photographing and articulating the deep sensibility of Japan. And I felt a calling for my time in the Tohoku region to start documenting Japan in this process.
Okay, so we're going to talk more about that specific technique that you use, because I think it's really fascinating. So before that, let me ask you this question. So you've been invited to give lectures and appear on televisions and, you know, written essays and books in Japanese too. So what kind of lectures and TV programs have you done, and why do you think people came to you to be there?
Well, I suppose, you know, having been a photojournalist, I've been able to see just so many different walks of life and, you know, go behind doors that you usually can't go behind.
And like so Prime Minister's airplane.
Yeah, or to go to these ancient rituals at midnight at Japan's Ise Shrine, the Grand Shrine. Going with 17th generation no performers deep into the mountains to do rituals at waterfalls. It's just I've seen a lot of Japan, and
like
people want to hear the stories.
Okay, because you are interested, like, you know, as Japanese grew up, and then you tend to overlook what's precious, right? Okay, and you also work as an advisory panel member of Japanese Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry. So that means what kind of advice do they ask you for?
Well, this all came about after the publication of my book, Japanese Power. It was read quite a bit by politicians, cultural and economic leaders. And at the time, the Ministry of Trade was developing this Cool Japan agenda. And so they asked me to be one of the members of the Cool Japan Council.
Right. Cool Japan is promotional activities with a lot of budget by the Japanese government to appeal how special Japan is overseas.
Yes. And the main focus of this is on manga, animation, music, entertainment. I came in, you know, to give ideas about how to promote Japan, also with tourism. For example, Japan's national tourism campaign, the slogan is Japan, the land of endless discovery. This is actually a term that I suggested.
Okay.
Because this was my experience.
Right.
I mean, even now, every month, I discover a new aspect of the country that I never imagined existed. So, I mean, for me, it's just, it's an ongoing journey of discovery.
Of that 28 years, keeps discovering.
And it keeps going, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, I was doing that, and then, you know, moving on, you know, I was also right after 2011, the Prime Minister's office called me in to help with PR strategy after the tsunami. And so that led to me having a photographic exhibition at the World Economic Forum Davos meetings.
Ah, fantastic. I don't think imagine you'd be like in that position 28 years ago. So that's amazing.
Neither did I. But I tell you, I'm most comfortable on the farm, though.
Okay. All right. So well, we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Everett's farm retreat. So please stay with us.
Itoen, the leading green tea company and makers of Oi Ocha, Japan's number one selling green tea, offers an array of award-winning ready-to-drink teas, premium tea leaves, tea bags, and antioxidant matcha powder. From the refreshing taste of Tea's Tea, brewed with only the purest of teas, to Matcha Love, taking a modern take on an ancient ritual, Itoen celebrates the authentic tastes of Japan with their 50-plus years of tea-making expertise. For a natural energy boost, try Sencha Shot, packed with healthy catechins and vitamin C. Do visit the Matcha Love store in the Mitsuo Marketplace located in Edgewater, New Jersey for their signature matcha ice cream and shakes. Hoji and black sesame are also a must. With a selection of delicious teas, teaware, and gift sets, Matcha Love by Itoen is not to be missed. For more information, visit itoen.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Everett Kennedy Brown, who is a photojournalist and author based in Japan, where he has lived for the last 28 years. I watched your brilliant 2014 TEDx talk in Kyoto called Focusing New Light on Memory. And it was truly inspiring, and I threw out the message. It was, I thought it was universal too. So I'll post the link to the talk on your on my show page, but could you tell us briefly what it's about?
Well, it's kind of heavy, but, you know, in our modern age, we have this concept of time as being linear.
Mm.
You know, the past, the present, and the future.
Right.
But physics tells us that actually that the past, the present, and future are actually coexistent.
Hmm.
But it's something that in our daily lives we don't experience. And so, I've been thinking about this for a long time. And what I was, what I've experienced in Japan, especially among traditional artists, is that they are channeling, you could say, ancient cultural currents of energy.
Mm.
These energies, though they originated in the past, they still exist now. For most people, you know, they think it's ancient, it's gone, it's forgotten. But Japan's best artists are actually bringing these energies up out of their subconscious, out of, you could say, out of the earth under their feet.
Mm.
And I've been wanting to articulate that through my photography.
Right. So in other words, the past is flowing into a current life.
That's
and
right.
Then you are bringing it to somewhere visible.
Yes.
So that we can be aware and appreciate how precious that is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, America's great novelist, William Faulkner, he said, you know, the past is not dead. It's not even past.
Mm.
It's with us.
Right.
And it's living through us.
Mm.
And in our modern age, we forget about this. We become insensitive to it.
Mm.
And so I'm trying to revive this awareness, this sensitivity.
Right.
And so I'm working with Japanese creative people to bring this sensibility back into our awareness.
Okay, and then, you know, before the break, you mentioned your special technique to take pictures.
Yes.
That's the way to actually practice your message. of the tip top, right? And so the technique is called spankoga. What is spankoga, and why do you use it?
Okay. Well, simply put, in English, it's called the wet plate collodion photography. It's using glass plates. It's based on a 19th century technique.
Made it in England.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, but what I'm interested in is not nostalgia. I'm only using the technique because it seems most appropriate for articulating these Japanese cultural energies, the tonality, the long exposures.
So how long is the exposure?
Well, if I'm photographing, say, inside the studio, we'd be looking at maybe 10 to 20 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of the major concepts in my work is that there are memories that are hidden in the landscape, hidden in the atmosphere.
Right.
And so I'm using this technique to draw these memories forward, and I have fun with it. I have dialogues with people from the past, asking for their cooperation. I mean, you know, you could say this is crazy, but it in one sense, it's a way to establish a communication with the subconscious, communication with the unseen forces around us, and the long exposures are a way to capture this ambience that that lingers in places, especially historical places.
Okay.
Yes.
So first of all, the technique, that's the wet film,
yes.
Right? So why is it effective to express the past appears in the current time?
Well, to put it simply, when you look at the photograph, it looks like an antique photograph. But it's actually the present.
Okay.
And so, simply put, you can say that even though it looks like history, it is the present. And this is also one of the messages that I'm wanting to convey, is that the history is not the past.
Right.
That each of us, with our own lives, we're creating history, whether we're aware of it or not.
Right.
Of course, you know, we're creating our personal history and our family history. And some people are creating, you know, history for their communities or even on a larger scale.
Right.
And so And especially with my audiences in Japan, they feel this.
Okay.
They feel a sense of connection with the past and with the future.
I think that one of the subject was, descendant of a samurai family from centuries ago.
Right, right. I'm doing a series of Japanese samurai descendants, Japanese aristocrats. I mean, people that have a family heritage that goes back 77 generations.
That's unthinkable.
Over 1,000 years.
Right.
And these people, they're embodying this heritage.
Right.
And the exposures that I use are, regular camera, you know, takes a photograph in like 1/100 of a second or something. In the case of collodion, sometimes 10 seconds or more.
Right.
And so you can see it in the eyes with these people, this depth, this connection with the past.
Okay, so I'm going to put up a link to your photos on the show page too, so that listeners can see it, because it's amazing, right? So, okay, and now, so you opened a Bronzefield, your organic farm retreat,
right,
in 1999,
right,
with your wife and cookbook author, Deko Nakajima. So first of all, how did you meet Deko?
Well, it's not a very interesting story. We met at a friend's house and had a great dinner together. And when it was time to leave, we discovered that we lived in the same neighborhood. So we went home together.
That's nice. Okay. Well, I think that's very romantic. So
it was destiny, definitely.
Right. Mm. Wow. So what is Bronzefield, and why did you open it?
Well, there are a number of reasons that we opened it. One was that we were living in the center of Tokyo. We had five kids. We needed space.
Right.
And so we had been looking to move out to the countryside. But on a personal level as well, I really felt that in order to really understand Japanese culture, that it was important to grow rice.
Okay.
To actually to get out in the rice fields, to plant rice, to harvest rice, and to feel that whole annual process of Japanese agriculture. Because so many of the traditions in Japan are based around the agricultural culture.
Yeah, actually, when I grew up, I really grew up in, it was in Tokyo, but in the suburb. And then, you know, there were some festivals, or, you know, festivals and harvest festivals. There's always around rice.
Most of them are harvest festivals.
Right.
Yeah.
And also, we say in each, every grain of rice, there's a god in it. So
yes.
You can't leave on your bowl. You have to finish it.
Yes, right. Yeah. It really, when you explore this, you see that Japanese food is not just about taste. That there's this very deep dimension to it that really, you know, it has a very long spiritual heritage.
Okay, so the Brownsfield is a cafe, inn, an event space, as well as a school of sustainability. So maybe you can tell us more about it?
Well, it's called Brownsfield. We started out with one farmhouse and a couple of acres of land. And over the past 17 years, it's expanded to four houses now.
Oh, wow.
And we grow over a ton of rice each year. We're very much into fermented foods.
Okay.
And so
like miso, soy.
Yeah, we make our own miso. We make our own soy sauce. We make our own vinegar. We make our own koji. And how do you say koji in English?
Koji malt.
It's kind of a malt.
It's a koji malt.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So it's just a enzyme to break things down.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And, you know, we make our own sake as well.
Oh, wow. So
it's not so difficult, actually.
Well, to make it right.
Yeah. It's not so difficult. I wonder if there's anyone doing that here in New York. Have you encountered anyone?
Well, there is a new sake brewer Boston, and I tasted his sake. It's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, and the Japanese brewers tasted his sake. It was okay.
Can I get it? Can I get it here in New York?
Yeah, I send in information.
Beautiful.
Right. So it's dovetail sake.
Maybe we can go after the show.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Okay.
Certainly. So do you have a cafe? Right? What kind of food do you serve at cafe?
Well, it's very much slow food. That's very much part of our philosophy. Most of everything is grown on the farm, but in our area, we have some of the best organic farmers in Japan. The Izumi area around the farm is becoming a major region for cheese production.
Oh, wow.
They're amazing. I mean, young people are just really making revolutionary new cheeses.
Interesting.
And they're integrating, you know, the European techniques with Japanese traditional fermentation techniques to come up with completely new flavors.
Oh, right. Oh, wow. That's the new way to ferment. I mean, fermentation, I think globally, it's becoming more popular. It's healthy and it's more fun, artisanal. I didn't know that it's happening in Japan in that form.
Yeah, it's really exciting, and I'm sure we'll be able to see a lot more of this as well. And also another thing that we're doing is we're reviving a lot of the traditional foods that had been forgotten. You know, 150 years ago, during the Meiji period, you know, a lot of Japan became westernized, and the food culture changed. And so we're looking at what kind of food was around before that time, and find ways to revive it and to improve upon it.
Right. So maybe that's a natural movement. Like even in New York, you know, people are more vegetarian and vegan. There's a major restaurant, also like homemade, handmade, everything.
Yeah. So, well, you know, I mean, Japanese traditionally were pretty much vegan.
Right. And before Meiji, we don't eat, we're not allowed to eat meat. Even.
Right, right. And I mean, think about it. The samurai, they were vegan.
Right, the rice was a source of energy.
Yeah.
Actually. Right.
Rice, salted plums.
Mm-hmm.
They got a lot of energy out of those.
Right. And you serve the whole grain.
Yes.
Rice.
That's important.
Right. So the Brownsfield is available to anyone. Our listeners can go and then.
Sure. I mean, we have a wonderful Country Inn that's open just on the weekends, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Country Inn that is beautiful. This is where Deka, my wife, it's her show place for
okay.
her food, and she's doing a lot on the cutting edge of fermented cuisine.
Right, and does she publish great cookbooks? I think that's available on Amazon, Amazon.com, Japan.
Yeah, right. Too. Well, in Japanese, she's got about 10 books out, and in English. She has one book out, and actually we've been approached about doing another one. So hopefully next time I'm on your show, I'll be able to give you more information about
it. Certainly.
That.
Right. So so the information about Brownsfield, that's brownsfield-jp.com.
Yeah, that's right.
So brownsfield-jp.com. Then you can visit and stay, maybe.
Yeah. And let me tell you what we're doing now.
Sure.
Our house next door that we just got last year, where it's a 200-year-old thatched roof house.
Oh, wow.
That we're renovating into the style that it had been.
Wow.
And where it'll have a fireplace in the center of the main room that people can sit around the fireplace and enjoy dinner.
That's called the Ilori, like a special center with the whole family, not just physically but mentally.
And there's something so meaningful about sitting around a fire hearth, a circle, sitting around the fire circle and eating. I mean, this is a tradition in Japan that goes back to prehistoric times, and we miss that in our daily life, you know, of sitting around tables to eat.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, the campfire has a very special feeling, like surrounding fire, but you can do it every day at your new place.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Okay, so let's go to Brownsfield. Is it ready? It's going to be ready next year, is it?
We're going to have our big opening July, actually, just a month from now.
Oh, wow, that's exciting.
Yeah, and it should be really fully up and going by next
okay.
spring.
Well, let us know how it goes.
We have to come next time you're back in Japan.
I would love to. Mm-hmm. Right. So so after all those years of tremendously interesting and deep experience in Japan, how do you describe your life in Japan right now?
Well, it hasn't changed in the sense that it's still endless discovery.
Mm. So you never get tired of being in Japan?
I never get tired of being in Japan.
That's wonderful.
I feel it, you know, that life is just, you know, a continuing journey.
Right. Well, I have to remember that because you're busy and then you forget about discovering something new every day, right? So I think most of us in the modern world, we're just busy, and then take a break, and then the busy day begins next day the same way.
But you know, in a sense, I mean, New York itself, I mean, it's things are always popping up, disappearing, reappearing, popping up. And you could probably even say the same thing about New York.
Right.
It is endless discovery.
Right. It's always like organically growing.
Yeah, especially with the restaurants.
Right.
God.
Oh. That is true.
I mean, every time I come, it's like there's a new revelation.
Mm-hmm. But it's not just a single restaurant, but I think people's mindset quickly reflecting what kind of establishments.
Yes, right? Yeah. We're really, I mean, this is such an exciting time in food culture.
Right. Okay, so this is my last question. So for listeners, what would you suggest when they visit Japan? Like, you know, what they should do, how they should look at things that they come across?
Well, I think what I would recommend is, you know, it's, you know, a lot of people go to Tokyo, they go to Kyoto. You've got to see the, you know, click off the famous sites and all. But once you've done that, is get out in the countryside without an agenda.
Right.
You know, if you're adventuresome, rent a car and just go.
Mm.
Because there, I mean, as I say, I mean, there's these landscapes that are full of memories.
Right.
And it doesn't take much to feel some special atmosphere in these places.
So I think the memories means the past kind of being forgotten, but the past flowing into current life. That's the memories that you can discover.
And it's still with us. Mm. So in a sense, I mean, Japan is and always has been a place for time travel.
Mm. Right. I think, you know, almost they like modern, or like, you know, if you go to 7-Eleven, you can still find a lot of pieces of tradition, like, you know, bento box to, you know, certain equipment. Like,
isn't it amazing? I mean, you know, that you go into a convenience store and there's something there from the season. It's very much, you know, they honor the seasonal tradition. You know, so you can go in the autumn and you know, have like shiitake or matsutake mushroom box lunches.
Right. So true.
Oh, it's amazing.
Right. Yeah, there's so many things to discover. I'm reminded by you. So, right. Okay, so thank you so much for joining us today, Rhett.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, please come back. All right, so listeners, if you're interested in Everett's work, please visit Modern Classic JP. And for Brownsfield, go to brownsfield-jp.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And you can sign up for our newsletter to get fun updates and event information at the bottom of the homepage. Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher Podcast. And today's show was made possible by Itoen, and our engineer is David Tatasiore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.